So we're just coming off of a time, a very inspired time of having our most esteemed elders from the our Thai lineage, from the Lumpur Cha lineage, come to visit Lumpur Liam, the head of our order in Thailand, and Lumpur Jundi, a very senior monk who is was ordained around the same time as Lumpur Pasano. And so for many of us, just hearing how others are speaking about that experience, it was, I think, just 5 or 6 days. But there's a sense of inspiration and taking in kind of a sense of what the practice means, what it's for. And I thought that I might talk a little bit about Sangha and why Sangha is so important for us, the meaning of Sangha, and having contact, actual physical contact with beings who are very well accomplished in Dhamma, and how important that is for us, and how kind of going it alone or just relying strictly on the Buddha's teachings and not having contact with other spiritual beings, but especially those who have really come to a very higher sense of understanding the path, how much easier it is for us and how much more of an access we have to the path, to the teachings of the Buddha, through the living beings that are practicing well and practicing directly and insightfully and with integrity. So those words are words that we chant almost every day, and they can have a kind of a rote feeling to them when you chant them over and over again. But they're meant as a reflection for us. So there can often be a question about what are we actually doing when we're chanting, and what we're usually doing is providing ourselves with insight and something to be grateful for and to aim for and to bring our minds up. So we're like bringing our minds out of the muck in a way. And so most people have heard this over and over again, but there was a time when Ananda, who is the Buddha's cousin, was speaking to the Buddha and came to this insight where he said, it seems to me, he says to the Buddha, he's also his attendant, and spent, I think it was about 25 years as his attendant, which is in and of itself an incredible gift and something that allowed Ananda to be so close to the Buddha. And the Buddha said, so when Ananda said he had this insight that the Sangha was half of the holy life, and the Sangha seems to me that the Sangha is half of the holy life. It's like it has that much meaning to it. It's so, so important. And the Buddha, as we have heard so many times before, says, say it's not, that is not so, Ananda. The Sangha is the whole of the holy life. And there is the Buddha actually saying how absolutely important it is for us to have these beings that are so well accomplished in Dhamma. And just to add a little bit of education around that, the word Sangha, there's a couple of different meanings to it. But when the Buddha refers to the noble Sangha, the noble lineage, the noble Sangha, he's specifically referring to any being, whether it's a monk or a layperson, a nun, any human being that has realized at least the first level of enlightenment, which is called stream entry. So that's the noble Sangha would be any being who has realized is either on the path to stream entry, or any of the above, which would be one's returner, a non-returner, and a fully awakened being, an arahant. And in this way, when we are often chanting, and even just in our daily chant that I'm mentioning, that's directly referring to the noble Sangha, not a general word. And it says so in that chant, these that is the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings. And so the four pairs or eight kinds of noble beings are those beings that are on the path. They have realized the path to stream entry, for example, or the fruit of stream entry. And then those two pairs go for each of the once returning, non-returning, and then arahant. And so that's when the Buddha is talking about that, is that the noble sangha is, it's really taking a refuge in those beings that have realized the Buddha's teachings and essentially have drawn themselves into the stream of Dhamma so that there is no returning from away from that. That there is an inevitable stream into enlightenment, and that is the direction where those beings are absolutely headed. There isn't a sort of falling back from that within a certain amount of time. And then the word sangha, in general, at least from the perspective of the suttas, is referring to the monastic sangha, and so the word sangha just means that the monastics, those who've taken on the vows and ordained. And specifically in the suttas, when the Buddha is referring to the community of practitioners, then that's called the fourfold assembly. And those are the lay men, lay women, and the nuns and monks. So we have these designations that the Buddha has spoken about. And he has said over and over again in so many suttas just the importance of living in harmony, having other practitioners who are helpful to us, being around others. And I think there's a lot of gratitude I have within the Lumbar Cha Sangha, because Lumbar Cha emphasized this more than many other monastic communities, that it was through living together that one really had the potential for the greatest amount of growth. And just coming back to the obvious experience of this time that we had with Lumbar Liam and Lumbar Jundi and the other visiting monks, it's so obvious just how much being in their presence could even create just a sense of a field of metta, a field of warmth and inspiration. So I think many of us are still riding off of that. And for me, it was just so many times just being around Lumbar Liam and seeing the other community members, spending time with him, and even more so than just the words he spoke, just the Dhamma he spoke, it was just being around him and Lumbar Jundi as well, just their physical beings, and watching how they behaved, how they were so graceful in their movements, and it really for many of us, what can often be seen is like, is there a, you know, it's been said, we've been talking about this a little bit, like, is there a person there anymore? Is there sort of like, it doesn't seem there's just like self so much involved. There's so much meanness or a sense of like preference or what I want or I need. And of course, you know, unless one is a mind reader, this is just an interpretation. But watching them and how they conducted themselves, it just feels very different than a regular kind of, as we say, patujana, sort of run-of-the-mill person. And so that is such an uplifting experience. For me, just those monks were staying at Santi Vihara, and I would stop in from time to time, and there were a couple of monks who were asked to upatak, to attend to Lumbar Jundi directly, and also who had volunteered, and Lumbar Liam as well. And we were able to be with Ajahn Saik here, who's lived in this community for quite a long time and is now in Thailand, or living in Thailand. And so there was this kind of beautiful experience of watching these monks attend to the senior monks and really take care of them in a quiet and respectful way, that was so inspiring for me to see. And just like the, you know, it's hard to describe, but the attentiveness one needs to have in order to really look after these monks well is a very honed in sense of mindfulness. Just to see, oh, they're walking away right now. I want to lift up their bag and take their bag for them, or you know, do they need something to drink, or is there something to help prepare them to have something in the evening or in the morning or whatever it might be. And then the care it takes to do something well, to do something beautifully. And so this was a couple of the other monks had mentioned how they could see this being done so well and being cared for. And so I think it's a bit of a back and forth thing when you see this kind of behavior. It's like those beings who have so much integrity and we are around, they lift us up into really the highest, you know, kind of way that we could really act or behave or be around another human being. And so it's such a warming feeling, and I've missed it. It's been a really long time. I think 2018 might have been the last time we've had any of the senior monks here. And so this was just a very beautiful experience, and we're going to have it again, which is another sort of luck of the draw that there are two also very senior monks who are coming to visit us in June and early July. And so we have another occasion to be around them. But the theme that I wanted to bring up around this is like, why is it so important that we have others who we're practicing with? And I appreciated a long time ago a metaphor that then Ajahn Yantako used, that he said that those practitioners that are our spiritual companions, we call them Kalyanamita, spiritual friends. These are our friends that are not the same kind of friends that we might have thought of in terms of friendship in our life before we became spiritually interested and were practicing the Buddha's path. These are our people who are really holding us up with integrity. And so it's our duty also to be Kalyanamita to others, to be friends to others. But what then Ajahn Yantako was talking about is he said that the spiritual community and those who are our Kalyanamita, and whether it be, as I was saying, the noble sangha or the monastic, the monastics we live with, that sangha designation, or the fourfold assembly, all of us as practitioners, we're constantly informing each other about our practice, where we stand, where we are. We're mirrors to each other. And without that, then really the holy life would likely fall apart, because it is so difficult to really practice on one's own, you know, to not have just a sense of, even just that sense of others practicing with us. I was speaking the other day to someone about how some people will get up at the same time as the monks at Abhaya Giri are getting up. And they said, yeah, I know when you're having puja or when you're sitting in meditation, and it's so inspiring for me to know that, like, at the same time that I'm doing that, the monks at Abhaya Giri are also doing that, and the residents, the guests here, just as a community, are doing that, and people are very inspired. And there's a sense of even communality around that, just the image, imagination, knowing that there at that time there are others practicing with us. But when we're living in community, we have an opportunity just constantly to be having a sense of, when we are around others, you know, what is the state of our mind? You know, how are we reflecting on our own minds? That can just be the inflection of our voice when we're speaking to another. Is there any sense of harshness in it? Is there any sense of manipulation? Is there a sense we're having that we're wanting to get something to go our own way? Or are there other situations where we feel possibly offended by another person, and We put our armor up and we want to protect ourselves. And then we engage in speech that we later regret. Or there are times, as I've been speaking about, where we're seeing two individuals interact and we just become so inspired by how they're engaging with each other. Even through non-speech, you know, when you're seeing other people in the community interact, and it's just done in silence. Something like the bowl set up in the morning, just watching the monks set up their bowls, and or watching the dish cleanup, or being in the room where the monks are washing the bowls, and just seeing in silence how something like this occurs and how beautiful it is. You know, nothing really needs to be said and nothing is left undone. It's just everybody knows their part and works together, but without having to speak. And this is a really wonderful quality. It doesn't come about without effort. There takes a lot of effort to notice and to see and to be clear about, you know, what are other people communicating with their bodies? What are we communicating with our own bodies? And so this metaphor that I don't think I even mentioned yet was that Ajahn Yantaka was talking about, was that really community is like a crutch. It's like a crutch that you use if you have like a broken leg. And that broken leg is just the sort of still being mired in defilements, not quite having possibly attained a level of realization. Then that is this sense that we're, in a way, we're kind of broken. We're not we haven't reached a level where we're acting in a way without, you know, that our bodies are pure or acting in a way that it's not broken. And so we are using this whole communal experience as if we have a crutch, as if it is a crutch for us. And so it's understandable that when you use a crutch or use crutches, you're doing that on a sense of a temporary basis. Now that could be many lifetimes, you know, it could be many lifetimes of temporality, but still it's a sense that this is what is beneficial for me. This is sort of the raft that will help me get to the other side of the shore. And it's necessary, it's needed, and it's helpful. And as I said, for those who don't have these crutches, maybe for those who are doing this alone, it might take a very long time to really understand the Buddha's teachings without that communal support, without that Kalyanamitta. So sometimes we forget that, and living in community can be difficult, and we can get into states, I think most of us are very aware of this, where we're just not happy about a particular person we're living with. And in fact, we can imagine that if they weren't on the planet, we would just be much happier. And we convince ourselves of that our happiness is dependent on this person going somewhere else. And if we believe that, then it's quite unfortunate, because we're forgetting that even those of us that we feel a bit ruffled by or have a difficult experience, they're still informing us. They're informing us of our own minds, of where we are with our own practice. For example, how, you know, metta is not something that is exclusionary towards those people we don't like. We don't say, well, I have metta for all beings except him. But at the same time, that might be a very real experience. Like, it might be true. And it might be that one can't feel that metta at the time, but it might be also that one says, but I, you know, I do have metta for many beings, but I won't share it with this person because of how I feel about them. And again, that's very good for us to see, because then we get so much reflection because of that. And so then we get to see, this person too is my Kalyanamitta. This is a person who is informing me and helping me in my spiritual life. And so, you know, we see that, and we see that because in community, mostly we can try to spot, okay, there are actually some good qualities about a person who I have difficulty with. And I don't have to see them as all bad. And oftentimes when we see this for ourselves and we have insight around it, it can absolutely change our whole experience around around metta, around caring for another. Because when that's seen very clearly and we see, well, wait a minute, like, am I right about that person? I mean, is everything about them absolutely rotten? I mean, are they just horrible people with no good qualities? And if we genuinely ask that and we say, well, maybe I can see something that is kind or good about this person. And when we do, then we start to see, wow, how did I miss that? You know, how is that possible that I didn't see that before? And then all of a sudden that person takes on just really a new perception for us. And if we keep paying attention, then we might notice so many good qualities that we forget those negative qualities. And they just kind of fall back into the background. We don't see them anymore. And that is a truly wonderful thing when that occurs, because what it is that metta has really opened up. We've opened up our experience of metta and seeing that kind of well-wishing for another, wishing for their happiness, wishing for their being united with goodness, and seeing them with these good qualities. So in so many ways, you know, living with others and being with others, it's constantly informing us. In the monastery, we have to deal with something that wasn't part of our lay life, and that is that there is a hierarchy here. We have a hierarchy of how we defer to others. And so for a moment, I lost mindfulness when I was going to begin the talk and put the mic down in front of myself. And I thought, oh, I forgot. There is permission that needs to be asked of. And although I could give the talk without asking permission, that's not beautiful, and it's not the way that we've been taught. And so there is actual permission to be asked of from the senior monk. I've never seen it actually denied. That would be quite interesting. But that's the protocol. That's what we do. And there are so many ways that occurs that it can kind of, again, it can work against our defilements, our sort of negative traits, because we might think, I don't want to have to do this, or why do I have to bow down to this guy, or whatever it is. And again, we see our attitude, we see this negativity that can come up, this sense of not letting go and holding on to our position or authority or our own sense of who we should respect or not respect. And we get to see that clearly in our minds. And so over and over again, this living in community, living with others, living, whether it's, as I was began the talk with, the highest of beings, or whether we're really inspired by the Buddha and we're just reading the Buddha's teachings and enjoying our taking refuge in the Triple Gem, or down to just our sort of, you know, interactions with those who are new to the practice. It's just a constant array of information for us around how we are doing. You know, what is our experience of letting go? What is our experience of understanding our own suffering? And when we're able to see clearly into that, then we do gain wisdom, we do gain insight. And this all arises through these interactions we can have. And then we have time to be alone and to, in a way, let the unwholesome dust settle in our minds. And we spend time in meditation and we have time to reflect on these kind of ways that we bump and grind against each other and how that really affects us, and eventually coming to a sense of equanimity, you know, that after years of practice, hopefully there is a sense of feeling more equanimity, that we're not so ruffled, we're not having such a difficult time being with others or dealing with others. And in fact, we can see it as the highest thing, is like how I imagine Lumpur Liam or Lumpur Jundi looks out into the world and sees beings. It is through kindly eyes, through eyes of metta, through eyes that there is, they of course will see, I think, gross conduct or things that are unwholesome in people. But it's not taken on a personal level. This is my interpretation, of course. It's seen usually from a being who has practiced so well as just caring for others, you know, wanting their happiness, wanting them to realize the highest truth. When I was, the last moments I was with Lumpur Jundi and Lumpur Liam, I just had a moment and I asked forgiveness from both of them. I said, it's my tendency is to move rather quickly, and sometimes I can lose mindfulness, and I just wanted to apologize for any way that I was offensive or with either my speech or my body, and it was very sweet. Both of them had neither of them said, yeah, you should be sorry because you're just a nutcase, man. They were just very beautiful. Lumpur Jundi said, oh, this is just your character. There's nothing wrong with it. It's each of us has our own character, our own tendencies. So I didn't have any kind of sense of offense from how you were, and then Lumpur Liam was just very sweet, and I don't actually remember what he said, but I remember just his smile and his eyes and how he looked at me after Ajahn Sekh was translating this for me. So we have these so many of these potential times that we can just gain so much from our Kalyanamita, our those who we are practicing with. And in this talk I've spoken about, you know, obviously the highest forms, those who beings who we really take refuge in and we see as like they're the ones who are really showing us that the path can be followed, and that there can be fruits to that path, and we can really aspire to see, like, okay, the way that they've practiced has been spelled out. They've worked it out. They've followed the Buddhist teachings, and we can see the, you know, just in their own behavior how they are with other human beings, how they conduct themselves when they're also just like in their kutis, when some of the upataks were with them. And we can be so inspired by that. And then with others, we try to do the same thing. We're trying to see the inspiration we gain through others, and then have so much of that reflected upon ourselves to see where we can move in similar directions when we see wholesome behavior, and let go of our unwholesome tendencies. It's kind of like, you know, when you see two people arguing, and when you notice in yourself that kind of pain that occurs in seeing that, and the wish for them to be in harmony, that's something to celebrate in yourselves. Because a worldly tendency might be the opposite, like, ooh, that's interesting. Oh, I wonder if this is going to get more amped up. That'll be cool. Let's see what happens. And we might be entertained by that, and that's a very sad thing. Because in a worldly way, that's what can actually occur as just something common, you know, the sort of the office gossip, or the kind of sense of like what our neighbor did that was so wrong to another neighbor, and it's just very sad when our minds are brought to that in a desirous way, you know, wanting more. And especially we can see that with our tendency towards entertainment, towards wanting to see that. And so when our minds, you know, the Buddha's teachings is more rejoicing in harmony, and people living together in peace and happiness. And that's when we feel that way, and when we see that, and when we are pained by seeing others not getting along, even though we might know that, well, that's just the truth of things, but what we wish for their happiness, that is something in the mind that we can rejoice in, we can be happy with. And especially for ourselves, as I've been emphasizing a lot in this talk, is when we are in community, we are with others, and we choose the path of carefulness, caring, harmonious behavior, and even to the point of maybe apologizing for something that we think we don't have no need to apologize for, just so we can heal a relationship or take care of another person who might be feeling negative These are things that are praise, something that is quite beautiful for us to really think about and emphasize within ourselves, and then also see in others when we see others acting in these ways, we can take note of it and put it on the, you know, sort of the front burner and really kind of say, okay, how can I bring this harmony into my own life? So whenever I am facing some difficulty, which is inevitable with others, I can raise myself up. I can, you know, go the way of the arahants. I can take on the Buddhist teachings and really recognize what he's pointing to, so I can understand my own suffering and raise myself up out of the muck, just as we chant like the awakening the lotus. So these are some words of reflection tonight, and just trying to keep us riding on that wave of inspiration and that incredible contact that we've been able to have with our elders and the time we've had them, the precious time we've had, and to really kind of keep that in mind and not kind of easily forget about it and get back into the sense of, you know, just the daily schedule of the monastery and that was yesterday. So just keeping that in mind. Anyone?